Welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, the podcast that equips you with the tools, know-how, and motivation to live your dreams and find your happy place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a recap of the week's guests and a preview of what's in store. To sign up, simply text the word happy place with no space to 33444. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the host of Work From Your Happy Place, Belinda Ellsworth.
Welcome, everyone. It's Belinda Ellsworth, and welcome to Work From Your Happy Place. Oh my gosh, today's show is going to be absolutely amazing. I am so excited. I have Gregory Jabara with us today, and Gregory currently stars as DCPI Garrett Moore on the hit CBS police drama Blue Bloods. He's won the 2009 Tony Award, Drama Desk Award, Outer Critics Circle Award for Best Featured Actor in a Musical for his role as Jackie Elliott in the Broadway production Billy Elliot the Musical. A University of Michigan alumnus, co-founded Impact Dance Company under the University Activity Center in 1980, still in existence today, a founding member since 1981 of the internationally renowned University of Michigan Musical Theater Training Program within the University of Michigan School of Music. He graduated with a BFA in acting in 1986 from the Juilliard School, and he currently resides in Los Angeles with his wife, Julie, and his sons, Zachary and Aiden. It is my pleasure to welcome Greg.
Hello, Belinda.
And how are you this lovely day?
I actually am in my happy place. We're doing this from my bedroom and I'm in my underwear. So I'm really in my happy place.
Well, there you go. Doesn't get hardly any better than that, does it?
Not at all.
I know. With technology, we get to do these great things from just about anywhere. And that's kind of the whole idea of the show.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So why don't you fill us in just a little bit on, this is exciting. I know I watch Blue Bloods every week, and it's just a great hit show, and you do such a great job in that. But why don't you fill us in on the journey of how you got there and how that came to be?
Specifically on the Blue Bloods journey?
No, just your journey as an actor, because I think probably
every like a day and a half for this?
You can do the short version.
Let's see. Specifically, like if we were to reverse engineer my career, most people don't know that I even had an acting career prior to my job on Blue Bloods. It's a very powerful medium. It's a whole other thing in terms of the visibility that it's given me and the recognition because it reaches so many millions of people every Friday night. Early on in the run of the show, maybe second season, beginning of second season, I remember Tom Selleck, we were at opposite ends on the makeup trailer, and he goes, "So it's different now, isn't it, Greg?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "People just recognize you, like everywhere you go." And I go, "Yeah, it's a completely different thing." He goes, "Take a minute and figure out how many people have actually seen you perform on stage your entire career." So I went back and I thought about it. And if I even rounded up and it was less than 5 million people of my entire career of acting on stage from high school, maybe even junior high, all the way through till my last Broadway show. There were less than 5 million people who most of them were sitting at least 50 feet to 175 feet away from me. And on this TV show, every Friday, there's 11 million people where my face is as big as their TV screen. And I'm in their home. And it creates the sort of ownership that the viewership has in on television of me as an actor that never happened as a stage actor, because there was a distance and people, I could walk out the stage door and wouldn't even be recognized if I wore a hat. Very an interesting dynamic, but a really welcome one, because there was, when I was a cater waiter studying, actually I was working at Mountain Jack's on Jackson Road in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I working as a cook and doing a non-union children's theater tour and hoping someday that I'd actually be able to make a living doing this sort of thing and seeing the careers of all these people that I admired. And especially as a young actor, someone like Gene Hackman him specifically, he was sort of like, oh, I'd like to be able to do what he does. Cause he can be a leading man. He's a spectacular, character actor, but it was like, it was an unknown what it was like to be, to know what it would be to be a working actor specifically, because even the journey to get into Michigan, I wanted to be a theater major. And my folks, who loved and supported me all through my formative years in grade school, and, you know, we grew up together, you and I, Belinda, so you know, we had everything available to us in terms of life experiences and education, from the sciences and academia to the performing arts. There was nothing that wasn't available to us. So we had the opportunity to, I was able to be in marching band, and I was able to be in choir, and I was able to be in honor society, and, you know, the physics club, and all there was a wealth of things, but the parents never said no. They never said, of course, it was like, yes, if this makes you happy. And these things were all validating, and gratefully I had abilities, and growing up was able to exploit them. And then it came time to make a decision for college. And I said, I really would like to be a theater major. And the folks went, you know, we don't really know anybody who makes a living, you know, in the performing arts other than teachers per se. And you don't really want to be a teacher. So maybe you could have a minor in physics and a major in communications, and you could get a part-time job at the local TV station, the U of M TV station in Ann Arbor, and develop, you know, production skills and learn how to make a living behind the scenes. And then, you know, if you still have the bug and want to perform, maybe that's something you could pursue on the side. So I'm a theater. I wasn't even a theater major. I was a communications major with a minor in physics, and spending all of my time performing. The people that were in my science track in physics, these are the future, you know, world physicists. And I was a guy who just liked blowing stuff up in lab in high school. And they were doing in their heads in class what would take me 3 and 5 hours a night to study for, to keep a pace. And I was auditioning for everything. I was, as you had mentioned earlier, which was very nice, is the Impact Jazz Dance Company, the soft show. I wasn't yet a part of the theater department, so I was part of all the non-departmental performing arts. We had a jazz band in our dorm in West Quad. Adams House Court Floor rocks, although they just renovated the whole building. It doesn't even, I can't wait to get in there, because I'm sure it doesn't look anything like it used to, and hopefully it doesn't smell anything like it used to. But it was while I was at Michigan that I realized that my gift, because I was constantly getting cast in, featured in leading roles and everything I was doing in the performing arts there at Michigan, but I was struggling to keep up in the academic world. And my desire was to be writing shows and putting shows on, and I wasn't doing the studying. And it didn't take, by the end of my first year, it was very clear to me, and much to my parents' disappointment, that I really wanted to be a theater major. That's where I belong. That's where my passion was. And as disappointing as it was for them, I think I was even financially cut off. But then I, you know, that's when I started working as a, I worked as a cook. I did work study in the cafeteria. I got a job. I auditioned for a children's theater tour, that toured the Great Lakes, and we played malls and academic institutions, and I was in heaven. I was doing what I wanted to do, and I was really, really happy. And it was also during that time that the faculty, I then became a theater major. I became a theater student within the School of Literature, Science, and Arts. And then there was a mentor who was there, Connie Barron, who really wanted to put together a musical theater program in the School of Music. So she banded about 8 of us, 12 of us together, people that she knew really wanted to be doing musical theater, and started the actual program, which is still in existence today. And I was really, really happy. And also that faculty said, you know, you have a passion and ability. You really should go to a much more intensive training program. And I call them the Michigan Mafia. Sharon Jensen was also a Michigan grad, a very close friend of Connie Barron, who was working on her whatever the musical equivalent of PhD or for something, one of those highfalutin, but she was an incredible coloratura soprano. But they were friends from when they were, you know, undergrads at Michigan. Sharon Jensen was the president of the League of Professional Theater Training Schools. And at that time, that was about 12 or 16 institutions that included SMU, ACT, University of Washington, North Carolina School of the Arts, Juilliard, Yale. There were many, many more. And it was a bunch of academic institutions that had conservatory-like training programs, or they were conservatories for performing arts. And I spoke with Sharon on the phone on Connie's behest, and she helped me understand that if I was going to leave Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's also important to know that once we got the musical theater program underway and it moved and it was under the School of Music, then the School of Music had all these academic requirements that it was going to require another 2 years of me to stay to complete the requirements to get my degree. So it was going to be a 6-year undergrad program in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I was thinking, if I'm going to spend that extra time, maybe I should go somewhere else that would be a better business move for me. And after speaking to Sharon Jensen, realized that if I'm going to move, New York City was the place to be because that's where the work is, as someone who can sing and dance and act. And by some miracle, and it wasn't the weekend I had free from my cook job and the tour of Sing America. The Juilliard School was auditioning in San Francisco, so I flew out. I flew myself out to San Francisco. It cost about $300, I can remember. And mm-hmm. and one of the things that to this day, I actually thanked Frank Donnelly when I accepted my Tony Award as one of the people who were instrumental in me getting into the Juilliard program. He was Michael Kahn, who was one of the executive administrators of he was the main acting teacher at the time at the Juilliard School. It was his partner who was traveling with him. And it was Frank who after my audition had said, there's something unique about this fella. He's worth consideration. It's a very long story. When you audition for the Juilliard program, you do two contrasting pieces. You do something contemporary, something classic, something. One of them has to be comedic. One of them has to be dramatic. So I did a scene from, I did a Lysander speech from Midsummer Night's Dream, and I did a speech from All the Way Home, the character of Jay Follett, which is a play based on the novel Death in the Family. But before I did my auditions, so everybody, there was like maybe 150 people there auditioning that day. And they brought everyone into the audition space before we started and asked. And we're all sitting on the floor. And they asked of the entire group, does anyone have a time problem that we need to be aware of so that, you know, we can accommodate you? You're not stressing out. And, you know, everybody wants to get into that school. Nobody wants to be a squeaky wheel. So nobody's raising their hand. Everything's going to be fine. But I actually had plans to see Three Penny Opera at Stanford University that night. So I raised my hand, maybe in hindsight, as maybe I had an agenda just to say, hey, notice me. But that's only in hindsight. I go, I've got to make, an 8 o'clock curtain in Stanford. So as long as I'm out of here in time to catch the train to get back north, I'm good. But it was like, I realized at the beginning of the day, I'm singled out. Just because of something I did. So then when I went in everybody's going in, 5 minutes out. It's like a revolving door. I went in and they said, why are you auditioning here? You live in Detroit. You're closer to Chicago and or New York. And I said, well, I'm working and I have my job. This is the weekend you were free. And this is the weekend I was free. And this is where you are. So this is where I had to be. So, and in hindsight, I realized they went, oh, here's somebody who's not just doing it because it's easy. Here's someone who's pursuing this actively, has a passion about it. I was in there for 45 minutes. I did not only my two contrasting pieces, but they asked me a lot of questions. I sang a cappella. We did some improv. It was, I remember coming out of that room and the hallway, which was not 8 feet wide and everyone sitting on the, along the walls. And I came out after 45 minutes and they're just looking at me like, who are you, Princess Grace, that you were in there for 45 minutes? And I just was on a cloud. And I remember leaving the audition and walking out that door, and the sky was never so blue, and I was at Union Square, and still to this day, San Francisco is a magical city for me because it was a great, wonderful things precipitated there. As it turns out, I didn't get accepted. I got waitlisted. And I figured, if I'm that close, doesn't somebody somewhere turn down a spot? I mean, who knows? They didn't tell me where I was in the line. All the letter said was, you're on our wait list. Let us know if you've accepted a position somewhere else. Otherwise, we will let you know if this turns into a formal offer. And while I was singing about the history of America at a Detroit public school somewhere downtown with the most beautiful, ornate wood and tile floors, it was one of the most gorgeous school buildings I can ever remember. Much older than the school buildings we went to in Westland. But someone came down to where we were warming up, I think, for the show and said, your mother's on the phone. And I went, oh, crap. So I go and I went to the payphone. There were payphones back then. And I call my mom and she goes, the letter from Juilliard just came in. You got accepted. And I remember whooping, like, yahoo, in the hallway. And teachers, like, opening doors, looking out, going, please, we're teaching. And I said, I just got accepted to Juilliard. And everybody kind of went, oh, all right. Okay, we'll give you a halt. We'll give you a pass on that. But it was, you know, that's the journey that got me into that school. But it was, you know, I had a lot of people encouraging me. I had to make choices to take some risks. It wasn't a hands down thing. But then there's a 2-year cut after the second year at Juilliard, which by some miracle I survived. And then PBS did a special about the Juilliard School, its 80th anniversary. And I was chosen as one of the 5 or 6 students to represent the drama department. So that was like the ticket in terms of my cotillion, my coming out party, you know, to the industry, because not only in your 3rd and 4th year, you're in New York City. So all the plays that you're doing in repertory are open to the public. So everybody in the industry who could be a potential either agent, manager, or employer, casting director, whatever, everybody's getting to see your breadth and range of work over 2 years. So they get to know you well. Then there's this TV special where I got served up on a platter and it was live. And literally the next day, and this was the fall of my 4th year at Juilliard, 3 major talent agencies called, and the school offices said, how can we get a hold of Greg Jabara? And within a month, I was signed with one of those agencies. And I'm still with, although, you know, agencies come and go and they get, you know, consumed by other bigger corporate agencies. I'm still with the same people that originally started my career back in 1986, because they have a character and we have a history too. It's
sure
you can't replace.
That's an awesome story.
Yeah.
So, and some pieces of that I had no idea about. So,
oh really?
Yes, I thought you always went to Michigan to be in the theater program. So, there's a couple of really good learning points in this, and that is obviously to anyone listening, you really got to follow your passion and your gut, because if you're not doing something that makes you really happy, you're not going to be as successful in it, no matter what. And that's just a really perfect example, even in your studies and what was suddenly hard, where suddenly you changed direction and now it's easy. I mean, you didn't have to work any less. You just worked differently and you worked at something you were loving. So
yes.
I think that that's an important lesson in there. And the other really important lesson in there is to find mentors. You had some really great mentors, and I know you've had many, many, many along the way that you really need to find and then follow their lead, follow that advice. You know, you can't listen to advice and then never take it or feel like you know all the answers. And I think a lot of people are lucky enough to find a mentor and then they don't really, you know, follow that direction or see where it takes them. And then the third biggest piece in that is it's not always easy. You going out to San Francisco, I love that story, because there are a lot of people that would have said, wow, you know, I'll have to wait till it's closer to me, or I'm going to have to wait till there's going to be one where it's more convenient. And, you know, convenience isn't always, the people that wait for convenience aren't the people that end up being at the top of their success game. It's taking the risk. It's moving forward. It's getting yourself in front of the people that you need to get yourself in front of and continuing to move forward in a really positive direction. So I just wanted to point a couple of those out to our listeners, because they're the key takeaways from your story there. Love that.
Yeah, you're spot on.
Great. So share with us then how the business today has really shaped your lifestyle.
Well, you know, early days, especially straight out of school, I would take any job that came, you know, any opportunity to start paying off my student loans. I was working probably the first year of my life Or my first year. I mean, I was constantly getting jobs. I immediately was booked. Actually, my first job was a TV commercial for the Detroit Free Press that cast and shot out of New York City. And they had no idea I was from Michigan. I just happened. It was just a wonderful, crazy coincidence. That was my actual first on-camera job. But my first voiceover job, which was while I was still a student at Juilliard, was a big national campaign for Norelco. It was back when, and you have to be our age to remember the Molson Golden couple, which was like this witty, sort of sexy, you know, playful dialogue between two people. And then, but Norelco wanted to like sort of rip that thing off. And they had these two really beautiful people. They were models. And it was live action, you know, live action stuff that was shot. But they didn't like the sounds of their voices. They weren't happy with how they spoke. So they hired myself and Lauren Brown to overdub all the dialogue. And most of it was like eyes and half of a cheek, and then the product. So we didn't do a lot of lip syncing. It was really about really capturing the essence of. But it was like 14 national spots for Norelco, which back in 1980, this would have been fall of 85. It was like a major crazy windfall. Well, here's my folks, you know, love me madly. And, you know, we talked about everything from relationships to safe sex but no one ever said, make sure you're taking out your appropriate taxes when you start making real money. Because my entire life, I was an exempt student. I never made more than $5,000, so I always wrote exempt on everything I ever did. So I got this beginning of this major campaign, and I get handed this W-4, right? Is that the first one, the W-4? And I wrote exempt because I'm a student, and I having no idea how much money I was going to be making. Well, when it turned into tens of thousands of dollars that were suddenly coming in from commercial residuals and I never took the time to look to see or even think that I just assumed, well, the government knows now I'm making more than $5,000. So they're going to be taking out, you know, whatever the appropriate taxes are. And no. Or I'm thinking, well, the checks go to the payroll department at my agency's office. So now they're taking their 10%. So I'm sure they're checking to make sure that I'm also paying the appropriate taxes. Nothing. And I didn't know to look. So we're talking holiday season there. I'd say maybe $60,000 to $80,000 worth of income, no taxes paid. And I don't realize it until I go to have my taxes done by my accountant, who is still my accountant to this day, Michael Shedler of Shedler & Cohen, who on the day I walked in with all my paperwork and he sat down with me, he goes, well, he's sweating bullets. Like literally, he's like Woody Allen with a handkerchief on his forehead, and he's shaking and he's going, how much money do you have saved right now? And I had like maybe $300 to my name at the time. And he goes, I don't know how to tell you this, but between your student loan and your federal tax debt, there was a lot of money, that I didn't have, tens of thousands of dollars. And I went, well, thank God I'm young, because the fact was I owned nothing. I rented an apartment, and my jobs were you know, either a commercial, if you did a voiceover or an on-camera commercial, was one contract for one deal. But by the time the government, when they were leaning on everything that I was making, by the time the government found any one job, I'd already made enough money to put some money away. And then they'd start leaning on my residuals for that job because they'd find that employer and that whatever state it was in or whatever. But then I'd book another job and maybe a regional theater job. And so I was able to make enough money to pay what I needed and still slowly pay off my student debt. I just let the government lean on my money. And I also made whatever it was, the minimum payments you had to, because they spent all that time and money, put that pay stub book together for you, for your student loan. So I figured I should really use those stubs and, you know, at least put $28 check in there and mail it in to tell them I fully intend to, when I actually have money, to pay that stuff off. So I went from job to job to job, but theater was primarily my greatest employer. And I think even right up until, well, before I married my wife and we started having kids, I was never unemployed from the stage. I had less than a year of unemployment from the stage from 1986 until 96 and beyond. I kept working nonstop until we moved to Los Angeles of January. So I had a blessed career in the respect that I was constantly working, but I never left a job until there was another job to go to. I was always grateful to be making a buck and would run a show into the ground. Billy Elliot, the only reason I left that show was because they finally didn't renew my contract. The only three of us original principal actors on the show who were from the original cast and were principal players, so we're making more than the, you know, union scale minimum. They finally said, look, we've made cuts in every department, but we haven't done it in the cast. And this, you know, 3 years in to help try and keep the show afloat, we're not going to renew your contract because you and Carol Shelley, and they said we could recast your roles and do it for a fourth of the cost. And that was truth. And that was sensible business. I didn't understand why they wanted to let their only Tony Award winning actor in the show let go, but they did. And then the show closed 3 months later. But before that, and I would have stayed. I would have stayed with the job. But then Tom Selleck came to save me, which was, he and I met over 20 years ago doing the movie In and Out. And when the film was over, and we didn't do a lot of stuff together, really, on camera, but we had a lot of hang time together, and we laughed a lot, and we hit it off. And somehow better than I would have imagined. But at the end of the shoot, he had said to me, he goes, you know, I have a production company and I do a lot of TV stuff and films. And he goes, well, you and I will definitely work together again. You're really talented and very funny. And on every job you have, you know, you especially as an actor, you know, some commercials, some movies, TV, everything's very short. And when it ends, the producers and the directors will go, man, that was great. We'll definitely do something. We'll come up with something else to do again. We'll definitely work again together. And if everybody who said that actually gave me even just one more job, I would never be unemployed. But, you know, lives move on, and people, you know, a week goes by and you're no longer in the forefront of their memory. Selleck, this is the third TV job that he's given me. He offered me, I did a guest spot on a sitcom that he had done called The Closer that also starred Ed Asner and David Krumholtz and Penelope Ann Miller. But it only ran six episodes. I think mine was the sixth, then they pulled it off the air. I had a recurring role in a pilot for a single camera comedy that he offered me. And that never went past the pilot stage. So I'm doing Billy Elliot. I'm a Tony Award winning actor. I'm thinking, and I see that Tom Selleck's new cop show is going to come and shoot in New York City. And I'm thinking, oh, because it's not like we hang out. I mean, we both live in LA, but I don't, you know, we don't call each other or anything. We have very separate lives, except in the professional realm. So I'm thinking, oh, show's coming in. I'm down. I, at the very least, I'll get a guest star on one of the episodes. And I went in very first, beginning of the first season, and I think I read for like three different characters on three different episodes at three different times. Tom was never in the room, although everybody who was there was lovely, but never, not any of those auditions turned into a job offer. And I thought, oh, the honeymoon's over. Okay. All right, there'll be no more Tom Selleck saving me with a TV job just when I need it. And then toward the end of their first season, I get a call from my agent. She says, well, apparently Tom Selleck wants you for this character that has a two-episode arc at the end of the season. The producers are wondering if you could come in to audition tomorrow just so they could meet you. And I went, and I have a cold. And the next day, we're putting in one of our new Billies in Billy Elliot. And I can't ask a young boy who's going to be thrown into the lions, his first performance in front of an audience, and not have me there. Cause we are, you know, tied at the waist for the entire second act.
Sure.
I wasn't going to do that. I said, so I told my agent, I said, you know what? I'm sick and I have to be there tomorrow for our kid. It's not fair to have him do a show without me first in rehearsal, so he knows what to expect. So I told him, tell him I'm sorry, but I can't come in tomorrow. And then she goes, okay. And then the tomorrow came and went. At the end of tomorrow, the phone call came and they go, okay, you got the job. They're gonna hire you anyway. And then those two episodes turned into, we just finished season six. And Tom Selleck, second, now actually has eclipsed my brother Dan, who's a TV producer, as my most prolific employer. And then third in line would be Jack O'Brien, who directed both Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and Damn Yankees, which I did on Broadway. And he actually recently offered me another job that I'm unable to take, a Broadway play, which 20 years ago would never have happened. I would have said, yes, please, and I'll clean the toilets as well. Definitely my career has maintained because of the relationships that I've had with certain people who have been able to employ me, which has been really the key. I remember the audition process for Billy Elliot and working with Stephen Daldry and Julian Weber, and they said, we already know you can play the role. We just need to spend more time with you so we could see how you deal with children and that you have the temperament for putting the kids first and the patience to deal with what it's going to take to be in a show of 40 some actors and 25 of them are kids. We need to know if you're like a paternal, individual. Right. And they also said, we know that, we're going to be spending many years, all of us together, once this journey starts. So we also want to make sure that you're the kind of person who we'd like to hang out with, for the very intense 3-month rehearsal process, and then all the insanity that follows from opening night to cast changes and technical problems and people nearly getting killed on set, and that you're the kind of person that's going to keep a cool head and
right
and so it really ends up there are a million people in terms of. Like anybody, I can think of 30 actors who could be playing any of the roles that I've done my entire career. But by some miracle, I happen to have the relationship with the person who makes that final decision. And that's been a huge, important variable in my ongoing career, for sure.
So that really brings us then to two of your greatest skill sets that have really helped in you succeeding in being an actor and in owning your own business. Because in essence, you are self-employed. I mean, you're promoting yourself on a continual basis, just like any business owner has and does. So what would you then identify as those two greatest skill sets?
First of all, as an actor, I think an actor's real job is to be able to walk into the room, which is, we're talking about walking into the audition. You have to walk into the room completely prepared for whatever it is they need you to do. So you've got to, depending on what it means, being off book, knowing all your words for an audition means owning the material so much that you're prepared to take direction and willing to go in any crazy vector that they may ask you to go just to see what you can do. But you also need to walk into the room comfortable in your own skin, just as you. There's nothing worse. And when I was a student at Juilliard, I worked as a reader for Simon and Cumin Casting. And it was the greatest education to be a reader and be on the other side of the audition table where you could see what happens when a person comes in and they're terrified and it makes everyone in the room worry for them and scared for them. Or people come in with a really bad attitude the other really important thing is you, make sure that, I'm in my happy place. I'm comfortable. That they know that I actually like myself, and I'm very excited and happy to be where I am at that audition at that very time. And those are important things that I think help. I also learned, and this is kind of specific to acting, but when I auditioned, they were auditioning to replace Jimmy Naughton for the summer of 1997. Yes. And so they brought in, this is for the role of Billy Flynn in the Broadway production of Chicago. And the person who was going to take over for Jimmy Naughton was going to start the week after the Tony Awards, where he just happened to win the Tony Award for leading actor in a musical. And then you have to go in. So they brought in about 2 months before then, they brought in 10 guys that they thought were the most close, appropriate choices of actors they all knew. And I happened to be one of them. I was doing Victor Victoria at the time with Julie Andrews and Michael Nuri and Tony Roberts. And I was playing a big, I was playing Squash Bernstein. I was wearing 3-inch heels in my shoes and my suit was padded out to make me look enormous. And I, for the majority of the show, I was a thug. I was a football player. I wasn't a cerebral genius, except in the course of the show, you've learned that this man is so much more than just a meathead football player. But I showed up at this audition for Chicago, and there's 10 guys there, and Billy Flynn in the show, Billy Flynn wears a tux the entire show. That's all he wears. So all the guys who showed up at this audition, everybody's wearing a suit, but I showed up in a tux. I wore a tuxedo because I'm going, they need to see me in a tuxedo. That's how it's going to work. And that's my commercial audition mentality. Cause when you audition for commercials, they tell you what you're going to be auditioning, whether you're a laborer or a working class guy or a businessman or whatever. And then you have to have like a bit of a wardrobe where you can put together something for when you go and they put you on camera for the audition. So you look like approximate what you think they're looking for.
Right.
So that's what I did. And it made a huge difference. Fran Weisler, who's one of the producers of the show, I walked in when it was over. She goes, you just look the part. She goes, we had to give it to you. It was like, it's crazy when you think, but you go, little things like that can make a huge difference in terms of success in the audition. I same thing with Billy Elliot. I actually went and I gained 20 pounds and I shaved all the hair off my head the morning of the audition. And I wore the exact same outfit, a working boots, jeans, a leather coat, and a work shirt as the dad did in the film. Because I'm thinking they need to see me in that role. If I go, hi, I'm Greg Jabbar with a lot longer hair and, Michigan accent, it's not going to.
Right.
You need to help these people, close the gap between. And also the other thing was the Billy Elliot audition. They didn't want to see me. The casting directors thought I was wrong for the role. And didn't want to see me. And my agents had thrown every other actor they had at the part. And nobody was, being called back. So they called me and said, hey, would you consider auditioning for Billy Elliot? I went, oh, they're interested in me? Well, no, not actually. We're desperate to get somebody, and they were just wondering if you'd be interested. And I said, well, yeah, well, they fly me out? And because normally when you live in L.A., and you've done as much Broadway as I have, if there's a show that seriously is considering you, they'll fly you out and put you up for a night to go and audition and then fly you back home. When they were going, no, this is actually not their idea at all. So you'd have to get yourself there and you may have to go to a couple of preliminary auditions before. And I was like going, oh man, what an ego killer. But I really thought after I researched the material, researched the show, this is a whole other journey. Stop me if you want to kill this train of thought, but it was the Billy Elliot came at a time when right after I did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which I got wooed out of LA to go do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels because the producer had said, look, you're going to be one of the six leads in the show. And there's a great possibility for a Tony nomination for this. So, but it was a brand new show, original show. I went in and it rocked it. It was a phenomenal show and I was terrific in my part, but it wasn't as impressive as the other people in other shows at that season that really did deserve the recognition for a Tony Award in terms of the breadth of the role and the physical Sure. demands and maybe the emotional journey, perhaps. Mine was just a lot of fun. So I ended up not getting a Tony nomination. So when Billy Elliot came along, the advantage of this was it had already opened in the West End. It had already opened in Australia. So I was able to do the research and go, is this a good business move? Because what I need now, it doesn't make sense just to go do a Broadway show to be away from my family, just to, have a job. I need it to do something to help me get the next job, the next step in my career. And in both other markets, the role of the dad was nominated for the equivalent of their Tony Award in that particular market. So I thought to myself, okay, this might be a good risk. So again, flew myself out and had my agents put their foot down and say, Greg's only going to come to the callback session. He's not going to meet anybody other than the director on the day. And fortunately they said yes to that. So, and then, you know, I actually saw Stephen Daldry earlier that morning because before they would let you audition, you had to spend an hour with the dialect coach. They wanted to make sure that you had the ability to do the Geordie accent because it's so important to the authenticity of the show. And it was before I had my haircut. It was before I had my outfit on. So I'm actually in the rehearsal spaces when Daldry showed up earlier that day. And we talked for a little bit, and he was, you know, very kind, said it was very appreciative that I made the trip out and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, probably, I guess it'd be 4 hours later, I walk back in and I have no hair on my head and I'm in a completely different outfit. And I'm sure that the effort that I made for the transformation had left an impression on him in a positive way.
That's great. So just to kind of bring out a couple of those skill sets to anyone listening, it's having confidence in yourself.
Yeah,
and that certainly just comes from practice. But it's also doing the research. It's doing the work. And researching each and every single one of those roles, going the extra mile to let people see you in that. And this is true of anyone that's doing a business presentation or anything else that they may have, whether they're running any type of small business. You have to do the research on a lot of times your competition. You have to do the research on what the consumer wants. And this really isn't any different if you take it and put it in a context of people that run their own businesses, because if you don't go the extra mile and do the research, that's at the end of the day what makes the decision for a lot of people, whether they're a consumer, whether they're the person, the director, whether they're the, you know, a vendor that's going to end up giving you an amazing multi-million-dollar contract. At the end of the day, if you're not prepared, you're just not going to get the job.
I would, because of the technology available today with the internet, I would ask my agents, I need to know who all is going to be in that room. I want to know every person that's going to be there. And then I would look them up and try and find a photograph of them and find out, because of internet Broadway database, you could find out what projects they'd worked on before in case, you never know. One of those persons may have been an investor on one of your previous jobs or just worked with somebody with whom you're very close. It made such a huge difference to be able to walk in the room and look someone in the face and go and call them by their name. And then as opposed to, hello, nice to meet you, it immediately makes it a more personal experience. And it looks like you've taken the time to care.
And, absolutely.
And knowing who the people are that you're encountering you just reminded me when you brought that up, that's also, I still do it to this day. When I go into audition for something, I'll look up the name, everybody that's going to be in the room. So when I see them, I can address them and know who they are. And as opposed to, I don't know who you are, but I'm just here trying to get a job, you know?
Right. Absolutely. And then the last one that you really talked about, especially with Tom Selleck, and that is, life is about networking and it's about building relationships, because the relationships we build in one area lead us into an area that we absolutely may have had no idea about. But it's being doing your best job always and then continuing in those relationships, being the person that somebody goes, wow, that he's a good guy. You know, I liked working with him. I'm going to work with him again. And then keeping those connections alive. I think so many people are one and done and they don't understand the value of networking and that people lead you to other people. And especially if you build an authentic and trusting relationship and then a professional relationship that people know they can count on you, they're going to refer you to others. It's going to happen every single time.
Yeah. And they do. People do cross-reference. I've in the industry, there are people who go, hey, I don't know this person. You just worked with them on something. Can you let me know? Is this a time bomb waiting to go off, or are they a pleasant person? All that, your reputation does follow you in the industry. I would imagine in any industry, really.
Absolutely. So now let's talk a little bit about an obstacle or a challenge that you faced and then how you worked through that. That's always, our listeners always love to know, like, okay, so share with us something that was really a tough decision.
Specifically with Billy Elliot, which was my last Broadway job, we had been back in Los Angeles for, I'm thinking, about 2 years. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels had ended, with the entire family was with me in New York at that time, because the boys were, Aiden was 6 and Zach was 3.5, or 6 months, and Zach was 3.5. So they weren't in school yet. Zach actually started kindergarten our last year in New York during that job. But we're here in LA, and I'm auditioning for stuff, and the work just isn't coming in. It's not there. It was during a time when there was a lot of production, runaway production happening in California. Everything was being shot in New Mexico and Louisiana and Michigan and New York City. So there wasn't as much work going on here. And my wife, we were at a point where, you know, we'd be lying awake at night. And I'm going, I guess I could take a cooking job. I mean, I could work as a cook. No, but seriously, or I could work for FedEx or something, because we need to do,
sure.
We got two boys at home, and someone's got to stay home and take care of the boys. So, and, you know, I could work at night, so I could be available during the day, or we were, the money was, you know, we were strapped, and we had to really seriously think about other alternatives. But the other decision was, is it time to throw my hat in the ring for another Broadway job? So there were a couple of potential gigs that season. There was 9 to 5, and there was Billy Elliot, and then there was a third that I can't remember at the time, but where I had told the agents, because up until then I'd said, look, I want to make it work in Los Angeles. So don't call me from New York. I don't want to know what I'm missing out on. I don't want to know, because I can't, my kids are now in school here. So I have to really try and make a living here so I can be home in Los Angeles. And that just wasn't working. And right about the time that we were really literally losing sleep, the agents then called from New York with that story about the job, the audition for Billy Elliot. When the reality was, the boys are at a great school here, a Waldorf. They went to a Waldorf charter school that was a half a mile from our house, that happened to be founded by Sue Addison, who co-founded Impact Jazz Dance Company at Michigan with me way back in 1979, 80. We just ran into each other at Sue Plantation one day, like 3 years before, after not seeing each other since college. But she was part of a movement that started this charter school that we were paying $27,500 for Zach to go to half-day kindergarten at the Rudolph Steiner School in New York, which we couldn't afford if it wasn't being paid for by the show producers. So when Dirty Rotten Scoundrels ended and we came home, gratefully, we had this school. And that's what we decided, we're going to stay in L.A., but work was not supporting our desire to stay here. So when the Billy Elliot thing came along, it was a worthwhile risk, as I'd earlier discussed on many levels. When the job offer, one of our good mutual friends who's been on the show, or
hasn't aired yet. It's coming up in just a couple of weeks. Yeah.
So Joe Aki was visiting us from San Francisco and was here in the apartment the very first job offer came through, and he was sitting in the kitchen and could hear down the hallway as my wife and I are here in the bedroom on speakerphone with the agents. And the agent goes, well, we got good news. You got the job. And then they told us the terms of the deal, which of course in any negotiation is always absolutely unacceptable. It's like, you know, they want you to work for free. Also, the other thing is, it was a completely British production company, and they don't deal in London. Everyone's in London. The movies are in London. The TV's in London. The theater's in London. They don't have to deal with actors who live on the other coast and then having to relocate them, or at least help absorb those expenses. In California, you have actors on the West Coast and you have actors on the East Coast. There, in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, we managed to negotiate a per diem that paid for our housing, a very nice housing for us when we had, you know, an infant and a 3.5-year-old. So our expectations were that that would at least be, and they said, no, that's not happening. No, you have to pay. You got to get yourself here. We're not doing it. So it was a long wrestling match for that. But that the meat of the story was I got the job, and this was going to be a phenomenal professional opportunity. And, of course, it ended up being greater than I could ever have hoped or imagined. But when Joe, I guess, could overhear the conversation that was going on. But when we walked out, you know, Julie's just crying. And I'm looking, you know, completely beaten down. And he's going, what the hell? You just got offered, like, a lead role in like, the hottest new musical coming. And you guys are, like, don't look happy about this at all. And it was like, no, the reality is now we're going to be apart for who knows how long. Because we can't relocate the family. We've got our nest here, so it's going to have to be a long-term thing. And what ended up working out was, and we had to really, we chose to find me a very modest studio apartment that was 5-minute walking distance from the theater, so that when the show came down, I could do the meet and greet outside the stage door, like a half an hour. And then I could be home in 35 to 45 minutes and immediately turn on what back then was iChat. And the laptop would come on here at the house, and I'd be on the Lazy Susan in the kitchen, and I'd be with the family for dinner. And then the laptop would travel to the bathtub, and I could be in the bathroom while the boys are having their bath. And then the laptop would travel to the boys' room, and I could read a book with them and then watch them fall asleep. And then I could text my wife and say, they're out. And then she'd bring the laptop into our room, and I could watch her fall asleep. And we shared, even though we were on, you know, 2,600 miles away from each other, we were able, we had the opportunity to share the end of every single day together, all of us. And that, if it weren't for that technology, I don't know that we would have seriously considered that job as an option, because it would have, it made the made the distance much closer.
And you were there, you were with that role for a while.
3 years. It was 3 years of employment. So Julie and the boys were only in New York when the boys were on vacation. So they'd be with me all summer, of course, and then, you know, holidays. But the rest of the time, I was alone in New York. But after a while, like, you know, after 2 years of contract negotiations, they're finally going, there's no more money. We're not going to pay you more money. So I'm going, okay, then can I have, I'd like a week off every month. And they went, okay. Actually, after the second, maybe after a year and a half, I actually asked for 3 months off. I said, I need to go home. If you'd like me to stay, I'll come back, but I can't be away from my family anymore. And I said, so I'd like to have 3 months off. And they went, all right, we'll do it. Actually, it was Stephen Daldry, the director, who said, okay, we'll do it. Because Eric Fellner, who I ran into after the 3-month hiatus and I was back on the show, I ran into him in some production building in New York, and he goes, and it was, you know, he's lovely. He goes, he just flat out told me, he goes, you know, if I'd known that they were negotiating that 3-month deal with you like that, I would never have done it. I would have said, bye, you're done. Thank you. Go away. And I was like, and I said to him, thank God you weren't negotiating that deal.
Right.
It ended up being great. I mean, they really did take great care of me, and they changed my career with the opportunity of being in that show. That Tony Award was put me back in Tom Selleck's memory and
right.
got me a job.
And it was such a good role, and you did such an amazing job. And I know for all of us here back in Michigan, we were just there the week before the Tonys, and just we had a big, you know, watching it in the living room here with all of our friends, and just we're really rooting you on. And so to grow up with you and go to school with you and then see that come to pass was super exciting for all of us. I can still remember watching it. Even my daughter, who's young and was much younger then, still remembers that event, because it was just, we were just really happy for you in that moment. It was awesome. So
thanks. I was happy because I felt, because of what you just said, I felt like I got to represent our world, you know? I got to be a product of us, you know, that I was able to represent, you know, Wayne Westlanders and all the people that, you know, who've touched my life. It was like, I loved it because I felt like it was, I got to share that with everybody, you know, who've supported and loved and befriended me my whole career.
Absolutely. So what advice would you give to others who want to be entrepreneurs, who want to go out there and make their dreams come true?
The most important thing is to really take the time to really be honest with yourself and find what it is that makes you want to get up in the morning. And some people can confuse that with, oh, I'd just rather just do nothing. Well, there are some people who are simply not motivated at all. But for those who take the time, because you know, your parents, your mother gave you birth, your teachers spent a lot of energy on you, the people you grew up with who were your friends, who were honest with you at all times, everybody who has kept you alive and supported you to this point in your life, the greatest tribute you could do for them as well as yourself is to take the time to find out what really makes you happy, and then pursue that with all your life, no matter how disappointed other people get. Other people have expectations, but if it doesn't, you know in your gut if it's not you or who you are, and even though it may seem like a struggle initially that people are saying no, you can't or no, you shouldn't, if you take the time to really know who you are and what will make you happy, and then go after it, that's the best thing you could do for yourself and all the people who love you.
Great. Well, this has been such a wonderful time spending this hour with you. And so why don't you tell folks where they can find you and anything exciting that you may have on the horizon?
Yeah, let's see. So, well, we're to the season finale of Blue Bloods. That's every Friday night at 10 o'clock on CBS. Our season finale, we have two more episodes. And it's not this Friday. Oh, but wait, this is going to air a while down the road, won't it?
It's going to air within the next couple of weeks, but it's okay. You can go ahead and get dates.
Yeah, we'll probably. So any Friday night, actually after May 6th, which is the season finale this season, then we'll be ad nauseum in syndication. So, you know, whenever you're homesick with the flu or the car broke down and you can't go to work, you know, just turn on ION or somewhere. But gratefully, there'll be a season 7. And there's a couple of projects, hopefully, that I'll get to do this summer. But until they actually make official offers, I don't want to
jinx them.
make any false promises. But you can always check in at Facebook. I'm actually in the process of completely revamping my website. But it's for those of you who are thinking, oh, I may know who this guy is, if you go to gregoryjabara.com, there is a much too detailed archive of probably everything I've ever done in movie clips and or audio clips, there for your viewing pleasure if you care to find out more about me. Otherwise, there'll soon be a fan page on Facebook. I currently just have a private page which constantly maxes out at 5,000 friends, and I'm going to take the time to have another Facebook presence because there's definitely a demand for it thanks to the fan base from Blue Bloods. But that's where you can find me, or on my bike riding either to the Pacific Palisades or Manhattan Beach Pier. Look for me between 8 and 10 o'clock every morning in my bright orange biker outfit.
Well, this has been absolutely a pleasure and delightful. And thank you so much for taking the time with us. And I know that everyone is truly going to enjoy this episode.
Thanks so much, Belinda. I really appreciate you including me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us at Work From Your Happy Place. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends. And be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. For a free gift on finding your own happy place, please visit workfromyourhappyplace.com and click on the free audio button. Thanks again for listening.